No, it's only seven, it's only, you got your numbers mixed up.
We're on the number 17.
17, that's 18.
That was maybe on Thursday.
That was yours.
That was next.
15 was yours.
Well, I think it's next to you. Okay, Larry?
Yeah, refresh me on how I saw other trees.
Well, they'd be a felony.
That would be covered under subsection 3 of line 11 through 13. When a felony has in fact been committed and he has probable cause for believing the person to have committed it.
So first and second degree would be a felony.
Now, what we're saying here, Mr. Chairman, is that we've now given police the authority to arrest people in somebody's home without a warrant based on something he didn't see, just based on what one person's word against the other.
No, we haven't said that.
Well, yeah, reasonable.
No, no, it says probable cause.
You can believe one person and disbelieve another. You can have probable cause in that situation.
We're not, the amendment refers to probable cause. In some situations, one person's word will be probable cause and others it wouldn't. What, and there's authority for this, and as Fred pointed out, in the drunk driving law, other states have a similar provision.
Yeah, but there's, you know, not that I know what you're getting at, and this, you know, every time we start trying to solve problems by, you know, you get police, if I put in my drug bill and you get a no-knock provision, and where the judge gives you authority to do all this, nobody will go for it. But now we're telling the guy he can just go ahead without any warrant, arrest somebody.
That's not correct. That is not correct. No, no, this, that's not correct. This does not give any authority in terms of going in without a warrant. It simply says grounds for arrest. He has to be lawfully, you know, on the, on the premises. I mean, if he is invited to the premises and he sees that the spouse has been assaulted, then he may make the arrest, but he has to be still lawfully in the situation where he makes the arrest. Doesn't give the authority for the officer to break down the door under those circumstances.
What composes, what is authority to come in? What if the wife just come in and the husband says, no, you're not, you can't come in?
I can't answer that.
Yeah, you can come in if you've got a consent of one.
I'm not.
Consent of one only, okay.
Somebody invite.
This is authority to arrest, not authority to enter.
Barry?
This is authority to arrest, not authority to.
I see it speaks to when you may arrest. The issue of when you are lawfully on the premises, I think that's another issue.
Yeah, but that is covered in the law somewhere. I can look it up for you.
Well, by doing this, are we enabling somebody to?
To enter the premises to make the arrest?
Yeah.
That's your question? I don't know, but I'll check it for you.
Okay.
I think it is covered, that's all. You might want to go into something else, might take me.
Okay. Well, she could do 18.
I'm not, my testimony is to indicate that I'm opposed to this. I'm just bringing it out for discussion because we are opening the door. Wouldn't it get beat up other places in the house?
Well, no, this is required.
There are people over there who have opinions and I'd like to hear. As far as the grounds for entering, I mean, you can arrest people for a number of things, like doing certain kinds of drugs inside their house, but that is a completely different issue than entering that house and finding them doing it. There may be, you know, a valid claim that the police have unlawfully entered, made a search and seizure, and therefore, even though they could have arrested for the offense, they were unlawfully there and therefore they can't.
Okay, I think I found it. I'm pretty sure this is the current law. Section 12-25-100. A peace officer may break into a building or vessel in which the person to be arrested. I can't tell, sure, if I'm just under warrants. I think this is just general arrest authority. Peace officer may break into a building or vessel in which the person to be arrested is or is believed to be if the officer is refused admittance after he has announced his authority and purpose. Now, this is not going to allow a no-knock entry.
You're talking about with a warrant, aren't you?
Well, I don't believe so, but.
No, probably.
I think this is general arrest authority, is you can't enter, I mean, because after all, he's going to give you permission to enter their house to arrest them. I mean, what do you think?
Well, you know, that's a new law. They wouldn't, and that's why you have to get a warrant.
Well, that's the idea, but you don't require warrants for felonies, right? And so they're saying, and maybe this is a bad idea, but the idea is to not require a warrant for this type of misdemeanor either. But, you know, that's a policy decision.
Wait a minute. You're talking about a warrant to arrest or a warrant?
No, I'm talking about making a legal arrest. Some arrests require warrants, some don't. Felony arrests do not require warrants. You can get a warrant. That gives you a lot of protection if you do. You don't have to have a warrant to make your own arrest.
Let's see if everybody agrees with the point that by making this amendment, we merely allow them to be arrested, but they would still have to have, they have to have probable cause to arrest, but they still would,
where?
If they couldn't legally enter, then they couldn't go in and make the arrest.
That's right, but this says right here that they can enter if their admittance is refused after you've announced authority and purpose.
Yes, but they still have to have probable cause to begin with.
I agree.
Yes.
They can't go in there to establish probable
right.
cause. They have to have it before they go into the house.
Exactly.
Okay, Mrs. Brett.
Yeah, I think it's important that we remember why this all came about, and that was because of the other provision about the cooling off period, which had all kinds of constitutional problems, really didn't seem to address the problem. So when, in that discussion we had that day, what we finally came to was that maybe the police should have the ability to make an arrest in this kind of situation, because there didn't seem to be any other way to deal with this really knotty situation. There aren't any easy answers to it. Maybe we should do it this way. Now, if somebody can come up with something else that will deal with the problem equally well, I'm flexible about it, but we've got to find some way to deal with a situation where a spouse is being battered and she's not willing or able to ask that the arrest be made, and that the police officer didn't see the assault take place. This is the best we've come up with so far. Something's got to be, some provision has to be in there to deal with that situation, and whatever we can work out is.
I guess I'm still unclear about it, but, okay, the police officer has probable cause.
Yes.
The individual is in his home. Can he go in and arrest him or not?
I believe he can after he's announced his authority and purpose.
But the law does prefer that you get a warrant.
It doesn't prefer, it insists that if you have access to...
you have to have a warrant.
If
what,
you go outside of the felon and the guy, you think you went home, you can't go over and search his house.
That's the point. There is constitutional cases that say you have to get a warrant whenever practical.
Right.
So that
could
be...
which means we're going to get into excellent circumstances.
Here's a question.
If there's no compelling reason why you can't get a warrant, you have to have a warrant.
So if we make this amendment,
this
is a constitutional case.
Mr. Chairman?
Me. Yeah, Mr. Dang.
I had a question. Mr. Dang, I have a question. If you go against well on the sidewalk, go that I want to comment on it.
I want to make sure that there seems to be some confusion here as to whether you have to have a warrant to enter or not.
It's probably a gray area that may well require a warrant. The court may require the warrant to enter.
I think there are a lot of situations in which they would have to get a warrant. Some situations that would want, if the policeman was passing by the house and he heard screams and yells and saw something going on inside, then he could just...
But what about the usual situation where their phone, either by the spouse is being beaten or by a neighbor?
Yeah.
In that case, I mean, that's the usual
situation. Well, I think that's why it maybe make more sense to read this in connection with the other suggestion, or because in where his phone, then he can make inquiry. And then, you know, if he knocks on the door and they come to the door, or then he has some alternatives, talking to people, and they get consent to enter. And then if they open the door and then slam it again in his face and he hears screams and moans, then I think those are exigent circumstances,
oh, sure.
which will allow him to enter.
Okay, I think what I'd like to do is...
it's pretty important, you know, address the issue of whether a police officer could look through a window and he saw a big bale of marijuana in there, whether he could go right in and arrest the people in the house. And he said, no, you have to go get a warrant. See, there's no exigent circumstances.
Well, that's not a case where
somebody can
be managed.
Well, yeah, there's a
search
warrant. It was a phone call, see. Well, it's still a warrant, though.
Yes, but the requirements are search warrants.
You're still entering the privacy of the dwelling.
Yeah, but there's a difference between entering to make a search and entering to make an arrest. And,
Okay, let's get the answer. We want an answer to this question, you guys.
I think I can give you an answer to it. Yeah.
Well, I want an answer that...
Did you all agree?
I want an answer that, I guess, is research, so we don't have people disagreeing.
I'm not sure we do. We could just generally discussing if the...
Well, I think that I'm very confused myself.
Well, I just asked a simple question of whether you had to have a warrant to go in there and make the arrest.
And the answer is, depends on the facts of the situation. That's the answer. It depends on what's happening in the situation. If there's a phone call and nothing else, probably no. But if he gets a phone call, he's going there, here's a few rumblings in the sign department, probably yes. But it's still a factual matter, not a matter of strictly matter of law.
He makes a very good point. Everyone objects. If that woman, you knock on the door and make the inquiry, she steps out of the porch and she says, my husband's beating me up. And then you go in there, you've got a problem. You don't have a warrant. You can go get a warrant. You said, fine, you sign this statement that he just beat you up and we'll go down and get a warrant.
Sure.
But you, well, I'll guarantee you, I've done it 100 times. You don't see how the Supreme Court, you cannot go in anybody's house wanting that. If you're in pursuit, if you're chasing a guy that's committed a crime and he runs in the house, you can follow him in. Otherwise, they're going to tell you that there's no danger. The guy's out there, the woman's outside. You have time to go get a warrant.
Okay, but what if the woman's inside and she says, I want you to come in?
You're legally on the premises then. And then you can make the
arrest. Between that law review article and doing a little research, we could probably get some kind of opinion.
If the woman came out on the porch,
yeah, I think
all
we should
you'd
do
have
that.
To do is tell her to go
okay.
back inside.
Let's
or ask her if she could come in.
Let's hold this in advance. And
if she invited you back in, then you can make a decision.
This is important.
If you want to pass a law that says you feel this.
Okay, let's hold Amendment number 17 in advance until we get something clear to us.
That's what I would do.
Peggy, do you want to talk about this Amendment number 18?
Yes. First of all, I would say that I feel that Amendment 18 is really compatible with Amendment 17. Amendment 18 would provide a police officer arriving on the scene of a domestic violence to have some alternatives other than just making the arrest. What we've done is sort of redrafted what was currently in the bill on page 91. And some of the changes are, for example, we extended the hour period for the cooling off to 12 hours. I spoke to people in Hawaii that were familiar with the enforcement of the Hawaii provisions, and they seemed to feel that a longer period of time was necessary in order to create any sort of deterrent for the person committing the abuse. Other changes we've made, for example, is that the police officer would not only order the person to leave the dwelling for a period of up to 12 hours, but also order the person restrained from committing or threatening further physical injury for 1 week period, 1 week period following the order. I think this is important for these kinds of situations because the person that's being abused frequently may fear retaliation if she goes to an attorney to seek a divorce or a temporary restraining order or to prosecute any sort of criminal charges that may arise in the situation. If the person violated the order by refusing to leave the premises or returning to the premises before the 12 hours or committing further physical injury within 1 week, then the person would be subject to a Class B misdemeanor, and that would constitute an offense. There was a section, Section C, on the first page states that nothing in this section would authorize the police officer to enter a dwelling in absence of the consent of one of the occupants of the dwelling.
Hey, doesn't that pose a problem already? In the sense that, sure, you may enter a PE if it's exigent circumstances. I was just thinking, you don't want that to be a broad exclusion to see. I mean, right. I mean, here you're saying nothing shall authorize a police officer to enter in the absence of the consent. Well, if you hear screaming out there, he doesn't may not have necessarily the consent, but we just exclude him trying to go in.
Right. It seems like something like unless exigent circumstances.
Well, I suggest you don't even. I suggest it's not even necessary.
It's not even necessary
to
say that.
Yes.
Well, it may not be desirable. What if the person really does not want the peace officer to come in? Wouldn't you want the peace officer to do that anyway?
To come in?
Somebody's getting beat up.
Well, that's exigent circumstances.
I agree, it's exigent circumstances. But what if the What if someone's getting beat up and the officer says, mind if I come in and stop him from beating you up? And she says, no, don't. Don't you want him to do it anyway? It's my question.
Okay, so I'm sorry, Peggy.
All right,
Well, I think in that circumstance, I mean, if he has probable cause that the offense has occurred, then he would have the right to come in and just as...
Yeah, I'm just asking as a policy matter. I'm not saying the way you drafted it is going to prohibit him from doing it necessarily, but what would you want the law to be in that situation?
Well, I think if the offense is ongoing and he has enough evidence that he should make an entry at that point.
Regardless of the wishes of the victim.
Right.
Okay.
But I think that if he comes to the scene and all is quiet, I don't think that he should have the authority to enter the dwelling. And that was one of my problems with the way the provisions occur presently in the bill. I think that pretty much explains the changes. One thing that I might add is the reason why I think it's important for the police officer to have the authority to either make the arrest or to have the authority to order the person to leave the premises is that, for one thing, I understand that police officers are already doing this type of procedure in Anchorage, and if in fact it is one of the goals of the criminal code to reflect reality, then this would be no sort of codifying what in fact some police officers are already doing. And then when one circumstance they order the woman to leave, but they're not doing it for particular periods of time, just, you know, they're ordered to leave for several hours or whatever. So I mean, I think if it's already going on, that there should be some protections for and some sort of standard set up for how the police officer can make such an order. I think it's also important because if there is a method of sort of dealing with the immediate violence of the situation, it doesn't necessarily put the abusing member of the household through the whole criminal process. People more likely, some people I think would just never put their spouse, for example, through the criminal process. And I think if this is a nice sort of alternative, that person who's being abused can still have someone come in and intercede for them, but without having to necessarily have the spouse arrested and arraigned, taken down to the police department. And in such cases, the amount of time that the person may be hung up in the police department may be far less than the 12 hours. So the person would get out of the arresting and booking situation, and, you know, very well may just immediately be able to come back to the premises and then retaliate against the person who was abused in that situation. So I think this provides for a lot of protections from that perspective as well.
Mr. Chairman, just quickly follow up. We want to tell, I think Peggy will have to agree because she knows the Constitution. And that's told me this thing is so raw to the constitutional problems. I think of going in and taking one person's word for something you didn't witness and order somebody out of their home for a period of a week with the penalty of a crime if you don't do it. I don't care whether the police department is doing it or not. I want to solve this problem, but I'd rather do look at something because when you get there, what's going to happen in these situations? Because I think there's so many of them. Mom's hit dad and dad's hit mom. And they're going to both claim they're assaulted by the other one and you'll arrest both of them. And which one is, if they both been hitting each other for the last 15 minutes, which one are you going to arrest? And or which one are you going to order to leave for a week? This is not the answer, Peggy, I don't think, in solving this problem. And I have a suggestion, but I know that it doesn't completely solve the problem. But when we get into a situation like this, we're just kind of broadening all kind of police powers here just to solve this problem. But I can see a police officer going to a house, and here's where we've been in problems before. And if a person's being beaten up, whether it's the man or the woman, and you say, hey, you stopped the crime right there, and she said, this guy's beating up, then it happens, then he can escort her out of the place. Take it to a battered wife, and then let them go get a warrant for the guy's arrest. They'll have to sign over an affidavit and go arrest him and put him in jail. You know, just like we've always done. What we want to do is to have the woman who's being beaten up or the man give the police authority to go in and decide which one to put in jail and which one to order away. I think the policeman, if we can get him to see that the beating stops right there and says, look, I'll take you in custody and I'll take you over to the married woman's home or I'll do whatever. But if you'll sign this affidavit, we'll go downtown and get a warrant for the guy's arrest and we'll arrest him and put him in jail. Now, that's why I've always argued for the night court, because I think we should be able to go right downtown and get a pretty high bail.
Get home within an hour, right?
No, not if we can set the bail at $50,000 or something, so if he never kills somebody, you know, if you get into a serious crime. But you're not going to excuse any of this. I go out and catch an armed robber. You can rape somebody, and they can be on the street in 15 minutes if they'll put up the bail. That's our judicial system. They beat the policeman out every time.
If I could respond to that, hey, first of all, it requires that the police officer have probable cause to believe that essentially that the assault has occurred. Second of all, it would only allow the police officer to order the abusing member of the household to leave the premises for up to 12 hours. The 7 days is only ordering him to restrain from further infliction of injury on the person who's been abused. That he can return to the premises and continue to live there, but he is just restrained from committing a second offense within a very short period of time. And that time period is very important for the person who's been abused if they're trying to make certain decisions, you know, in their life with respect to legal actions or what have you.
How does he report this commitment to the courts that he's issued this order of restraint? Will we give the police order of permission to issue restraints against people now? And if he breaks the restraint, what order do you violate? The policeman's word. He'll be off duty that day, and they do it again. Does someone just go out and arrest this person because some police officer told him that they shouldn't have done that the next week? I see a whole kind of problem with Peggy being built up here in allowing police officers to put people on restraining order.
Yeah, I'd like to see how that.
And then say, you go right back into the situation, but if you get in trouble, we're going to arrest you. I can see if they got a whole week to go to court to get a restraining order against this guy. And they're just circling the due process of law and not everything we've written here.
Well, in a civil court, I can get a restraining order against an abusing spouse for up to, I think, 10 days with that ex parte without even notifying them.
You have to make a pretty strong showing that notice.
Not much of a showing. I tried to call them once and respond to a phone call.
Sure.
You have to file a certificate as the reason why you're doing an ex parte. But it's been done.
Without
any notice, and at least in this case, the person would be getting notice.
Yeah, just, it's my feeling, and Peggy and I discussed this beforehand, that Amendment 18 is unnecessary if you go ahead with Amendment 17, that the peace officer will have the authority to make the arrest. That authority will carry with it, I think, if the natural tendency to say, hey, buddy, you can avoid arrest if you do this, and that is leave the premises and don't come back. I mean, I just think that 18 states, I think, pretty much the obvious, except for the fact of the week period, which I think is probably, I mean, I'd have to give it a lot of thought, but it doesn't look right to me. I don't think the officer could do that. So, you know, my recommendation, you know, simply is staff on this, is to be sure that 17, that we know what 17 does, and then when we know what 17 does, to pass it, you want to do it and not have a provision that resembles 18 at all. Lisa?
Well, I tend to agree with Barry. Once we find out what 17 does, and if we can make something workable out of 17, mostly on the basis of the problems that were raised the last time we dealt with this cooling off period. I like the idea of the cooling off period. It's not the only solution. But I do understand that there are real problems with making it work and with really making the situation any better.
Larry?
Did you comment on the 17th? Would you like that letter to be sent through?
No, there's a problem with that in my mind. It's going to make Christmas job easier if you can go soft on these problems. You know, it's a misdemeanor committed because someone told you you got to take someone's word about who's doing it. Well, I worry about why don't we just say that in the school told the police officer, you got to beat the police and what's going to stop you, they'd make an arrest. Well, what's the difference if you get beat up down there in an hour?
Well, it doesn't. The way it goes, see, that's the, no, but
you're in that person's home.
But
and there we get back to the whole issue.
It doesn't apply, though. I mean, you're ignoring the, I mean, you're confusing the issue. The way 17 is amended, it doesn't require that the assault occur in the dwelling. The assault could have occurred anywhere. It could have occurred in the street. It just was out of sight of his presence. So it's not tied at all to assaults in the home.
This same thing happened down there in a bar, then you go up to his house and tell him he's got to leave the house for a week.
All I'm talking about is 17.
Oh, assault. Yeah, okay.
No. It's more than assault. It's simply, it doesn't, 17, and all I want you to pass, I think, is 17, is that it says it applies to any misdemeanor assault not occurring in the person's presence, but it has to involve members of the same household. It doesn't cover a bar assault between two people unless they're members of the same household.
Well,
so there is no...
If it's legal, I've got no real problem with that, if it's legal, you know,
well, I think we should have some clarification in legislative affairs.
I'll only give you a preliminary idea that the problems with this will not be statutory, they will be constitutional, and there's nothing you can do about them. You know, if there are constitutional restrictions on when you can go into somebody's home, you can pass a statute for now, and doomsday is going to make a difference.
That's right, and I think you're going to underestimate
it. I agree. There would certainly be an area where it would be governed by the Constitution more strictly than the statute.
Larry, did you
have
a question?
Well, what would the constitutional question be? With or without a warrant, or with a warrant?
Whether a warrant was required in the situation. It's my recollection of those cases that you're required to get a warrant whenever practicable to go to to enter someone's home without consent. Now, the question is, what's that? And it seems to me probably, I know I'm not supposed to be talking, I'll shut up in a minute, probably the person is going to be impracticable to get a warrant when people are fighting right then. It would be, seem to me, much more practical if they were just sitting around bleeding or something, you know, not really engaged in it.
Usually these things happen at night.
Yeah,
I think they usually happen at night. Does that mean it's not practical?
Not necessarily. I think the judges have been gotten out of bed before.
Oh boy.
Now, I'm sure Ed knows more about this than I do, but there have been warrants issued at night.
Could you find for us definition of practical?
Yeah, there are cases on it that deal with specific situations that have been litigated.
Yeah, could you give us some guidance on that?
What, yeah,
and
right.
Anything else?
Okay.
We're looking for guidance.
Right, we'll research.
Don't have to stay overnight.
Well, you one minute you're breaking up the fight, now you're trying to solve a social problem. And
that might create social
problems.
Meeting February 24th, 1978, adjourned 5:30 p.m.
Okay, we'll call a meeting to order. And of course, we're working on the criminal code. What's that? This is Rada.
How long are we going to go?
Till 12 o'clock.
Okay,
I'd like to.
Thank you.
We won't leave you down there. Just to make everybody feel good today, since things haven't gone, this amendment number 19.
I want to welcome Mr. Clarkson. Tell him my husband's not in Hawaii.
This is an amendment to the amendment number 7 of 22178. Use of force by peace officers and a number of other things, not a number of other situations. The reason I wanted to give out this amendment was because, just because we worked on it a lot, I wanted to see how it looked. What we had done, also, I think, is we cleaned it up in terms of getting rid of some excess language.
What page are we talking about?
Well, it's an amendment. It's an amendment.
We've already done.
Yeah,
right?
You already adopted the amendment. Now I worked on it with the changes and bringing it back.
Yeah.
But it was amendment number 7 of 22178.
Okay, do you remember what page that section?
Yeah, one second. Yeah, of the amendment, it was on page, the first page is, starts on the bottom of page 3. Okay, let me just point out what we've done. Number 1, we combine the two sections covering non-deadly and deadly force into one section because it was easy to do. Number two, we eliminated the language about an officer need not retreat or desist from efforts to make an arrest because of threat of resistance by the arrestee. The reason we've done that was that it's already covered under use of force and self-defense, which says there's no duty to retreat by a peace officer. So it was just unnecessary language, taking that out. On page one of the new amendment, line 17 through 18, you see the language you adopted, may otherwise endanger life or inflict serious physical injury unless arrested without delay. Lines 19 through 21, we've changed that. Previously, it only applied to what it said is that the use of force is not justified unless the peace officer reasonably believes the arrest is lawful. We've added the word stop, since this applies to stop, which the limitation subsection B should apply that way too. On page two of the amendment, the second page of the amendment, the only change there is we eliminated, by the way, this is on page four of the original amendment. Okay. The only change we've done here is that in the use of deadly force in line 16, previously it referred to, in line 17, reasonably believes necessary to carry out the police officer's direction or authorization. That's what it said in the original. We never used the word authorization throughout the other section, so we knocked that out. On the next page, we've combined This is use of force by a private person in making an arrest, and that was previously on page five, and we haven't made any changes there other than again to simplify it, to eliminate some of the verbiage. I think if after three amendments we finally got it down that someone could look at it and know pretty well when you could use force. So I wanted to bring that back to you. Oh, there is one policy issue you have to decide, and that is if you turn to page one of the amendment number 19, you see that we added subsection 3, may otherwise endanger life and inflict serious physical injury. Now, you already had made a policy decision that the situations where a private person can use deadly force should be identical to the situations where a peace officer should use deadly force in making an arrest. However, that decision came before you adopted number 3 on page 1. So if you turn to page 3 of the amendment, the last page, you see that there is no subsection 3 on those circumstances, and I would recommend that not be included. I think that the use of force by a private citizen should be limited to 1 and 2. Subsection 3 on page 1 deals with circumstances where you wanted to give the police officer some leeway, and I think that should only apply to peace officers, not private citizens.
Any questions, discussion on these sections?
Bill? Mr. Chairman, throughout the section we talked about deadly force, not deadly force, and then Barry, you used in on page 1, line 16, and
yes.
Then again on page 3, line 16, you used firearm.
Yes.
Shouldn't we be talking about deadly weapon there?
Well, no, I don't think we should. For a number of reasons. Number one, subsection 2 on page 1, which is the one we're discussing for both circumstances, expands existing law in that it allows a peace officer to use deadly force against a misdemeanant. Since subsection 2 does not apply to just felons, it applies to anyone. And the commission felt that that the potential for including a deadly weapon or, say, even a dangerous instrument there was too great in terms of authorizing deadly force, and it should be simply limited to firearms. I think subsection 2 is a significant broadening of existing law, and the commission wanted to ensure that it be as restrictive as possible. So,
well, and then wouldn't the situation arise where the custodian of the person could have a knife in his ribs and couldn't do anything about it?
Oh no, the knife in the ribs, that's self-defense. I mean, that's why every one of these sections start on page 1, line 5, in addition to using force justified under other sections. That would be...
Wouldn't it be an arguable situation that this section would...
No,
that would only come up, Bill, in the sense that
if this one, if the person had a firearm on him, whether he was using it or flourishing it or not, he could shoot him. And in the same case, if he was threatening him with a knife, then there's no problem with the officer doing something. But if he simply had a knife on his belt.
That's right, and that's the situation we wanted to avoid. Since this does apply to misdemeanors, if you put a deadly weapon, anyone fleeing from an officer with a knife on his belt would be, you could use deadly force. And again, it's in addition to the sections on deadly force and self-defense.
Plus you have subsection 1 there, which involves when the force is actually being used.
Okay. Yeah, I think you have.
Okay. Well, we've already adopted this amendment, actually, so...
Yeah, I think it's just...
Unless somebody has any objections to how it's drafted. Well, that's
correct. I guess I don't know why we don't want to extend subsection 3 to the private person. I think I can come up hypothetically with a number of cases in which you'd probably want to.
What's one of your hypotheticals?
Well, what if we were walking down the street and there was a person who was using a knife and he was using the knife to throw at kids.
I'm sorry, to what?
He's throwing a knife at kids.
Throwing a knife at kids?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And you had to use deadly force to get him to stop.
Oh, well, that's already, that's again, subsection page 1, page lines 5 and 6. Oh, I'm sorry, page 3, lines 2 and 3. In addition to using force justified under other sections of this chapter, one of the other sections is use of force in defense of third persons. And when you think that a person is in danger of serious injury, you may use deadly force in that person's defense.
Even if it's a stranger, it doesn't have to be someone you know or are involved in. It just happened upon
you. So the self-defense and defense of others is already covered.
I think, Larry, when we looked at this before, that actually number 3, it's pretty hard to think of something that is included in 1 and 2, but there was this feeling that you have to allow the police officer some kind of discretion. And there was some argument that almost everything you could think of that comes under some other section already, and maybe there's not even a need for number 3. That's right.
The difference is, I think, that what you're doing with police officers is giving them the power to act in situations that may arise in the future, may otherwise endanger life, or inflict serious physical injury, whereas before, for the citizens, you're limiting them to situations that have already arisen, like attempting to escape or escaping, or attempting to commit or committing. What you're doing with the police is broadening it so that they can deal with situations they think are imminent rather than have to be occurred. So I think that's probably a distinction that ought to be made.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any further questions on this?
Okay, the next issue I'd like to give out is on possession of gambling devices, and you should turn to page 116.
The amendment number
116, the possession of gambling devices offense prohibits the possession of any slot machine. The amendment provides that slot machines simply be treated as regular gambling devices and the culpability requirement should be identical, and that is on line 8 of the amendment. that you possess it, use it, or sell it with reckless disregard that the device is used or is to be used in unlawful gambling. Under the bill as drafted, if it was a gambling device other than a slot machine under subsection 1, you had to prove that specific intent, whereas it was a slot machine, you didn't. And the point that was made, and I believe a bill just passed the Senate, that people have antique slot machines. So the amendment applies the same culpability requirement.
It's been withdrawn from the Senate and referred back to judiciary.
That's true, but it's still there.
Yeah.
And whose bill is it?
I believe it's by request.
I believe they're asking George Hammond County.
Common by request, I believe.
So.
I know I've got several calls from guys in Anchorage who have and collect. Fred Child is one of them. He collects old slot machines. Different guys have them at home. Again, I guess we're back to trying to make it okay to gamble in a social game at home or something. He was more concerned about his right to not have it confiscated.
The reason he was concerned about that, I think, is because it's not now a crime to possess it.
Well, and why should it be, or can it be used only in a social game?
That's the whole point of this amendment, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
The whole point is that it has to be, he has to have reckless disregard that the device is used or is to be used in unlawful gambling.
Well, this is right. Unlawful gambling does include social games, gaming. But then that's why we have the defense in subsection B.
Yeah.
And what does C say? Possession of a gambling device is a violation.
That is correct.
That means it's not
I think that there is some, myself, I think it's probably misclassified, but I think that's a misclassification issue.
Well, I don't have a problem if you say that, will this allow people to possess, you know, the guy that just has collector's eyes?
That's the whole point of the amendment.
And what's to keep, is there enough protection there so that back to the professional gambler could set up a few slot machines in his house and have a game going?
Well, in addition to be guilty of the offense of promoting unlawful gambling in the first degree, he would be also guilty of possession of a gambling device. So, yes, there is.
Okay.
Is there a motion? I'll move to that. Actually, I was concerned.
Yeah, there's no objection. Then the number 20 is
I don't want to, but I think I guess it's kind of an obligation. I don't want you to be
Mr. Chairman, there's another amendment.
This amendment number 21.
Mike, leave him alone.
Is this adopted?
Yes.
Amendment number 20 was adopted.
Probably remember this one from the last day of the subcommittee meeting. This was inadvertently left out of the bill. The committee in deciding gambling offenses wanted to provide a forfeiture of gambling devices and certain types of money used in unlawful gambling. And this is the bill that was, this is the section of the gambling thing that was drawn up. Now, if you note on line 10, it says, is provided in blank. Now, when the committee was originally working on it, I guess they were thinking, and I mean, I was thinking as a drafter, that there would be one forfeiture provision in the criminal code that would apply to, you know, both drug offenses and gambling implements. But that never came about. Just as a result of, I guess, some decision to withdraw the governor's drug bill. Anyway, what the forfeiture provision allows for is forfeiture of a gambling device, money not found on the person used as a bed or a stake, and then subsection 3 was the more controversial provision, money used as a bed or a stake, which is found on the person of one who conducts, finances, etc., on a lawful gambling enterprise. Now, the thing is we say it's subject to forfeiture, but we don't really say what that means. you know, in other words, what the procedure is, what happens to it. We simply could provide, it's subject to forfeiture and shall be disposed of by the Department of Public Safety or by the Attorney General as they determine. I think that eventually, someday, there should be a forfeiture procedure provision, but it ain't gonna, you know, I just can't see it going into the criminal code simply because it hasn't been started. I think it's a fairly controversial subject. So if you want to provide the forfeiture at all, I think you should include this and simply say the following property is subject to forfeiture and shall be disposed of as provided by, say, the Department of Public Safety or by the Attorney General. It doesn't answer a lot of questions. It doesn't answer whether you could go forfeiture civilly. It doesn't answer really whether you can, you know, the only time you forfeit something is when you arrest someone. But this was one of the committee's, one of the subcommission's recommendation. And I should point out 2 and 3, under existing law, you really can't forfeit money in using gambling games because the existing statute 1145.040 says that things seized in a gambling, basically gambling raid shall be seized and destroyed. And the court says you can't destroy money. This is attempting to allow you to seize the money, use it to buy cars or something.
Did you see, if y'all looked at the forfeiture provision in that, and
I think Jim is very familiar with it.
Yeah, there's nothing on the procedure in the bill. It just says it shall be forfeited. Or there's some things in here, as I recall, about not having to have hearings or anything can be summarily forfeited, but I don't believe that, you know, they get too detailed about exactly what happens to the property. I don't know that you need to in a statute.
I don't know. I thought they mentioned you might want to look at that bill because when Kent drew that up, based on his experience as attorney general and the U.S. attorney, and the federal statute came up with that language, so you might want to look at it and see how
it works. I thought it was pretty good language.
It might be useful.
Aren't you, by saying it's subject to forfeiture, you're leaving a question as to whether, in fact, it will be forfeited, isn't that correct?
Well, I think that you have to make a certain showing in order to have something forfeited, and one of the things you have to show, I guess, is that was used in violation of, I understand your point, I have to agree.
The question I'm raising is whether we shouldn't just say shall be forfeited.
I think that's correct.
I don't know the answer to it.
Okay, we did.
If you say it's subject to forfeiture, then you do have to have somebody set up a procedure.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, I agree. If you want to take, I think that in terms of the criminal code provision, you simply might say that the following provision shall be forfeited. Let someone decide how it's going to be forfeited.
We have one problem with that, particularly in Section 3, and we've gone into that before. Guys playing a game, you know. And he's got $500 or $600, but he's on the phone, you know, he's not running the game. Would he be included where if they take all of his money out of his pocket at the time?
Well,
or is that even though
if you look at the subsection, the way it's drafted is that subsection 2 says if it's not found on the person, in other words, it's on the table, essentially, it'll be subject to forfeiture. And that's how the commission proposal originally read it, just subsection 1 and 2.
Well, Jim and Perry, is it okay really to just leave the section saying the phone property shall be subject to forfeiture, period?
I believe that the Supreme Court would probably take care of that by rule if you didn't prescribe one. I'm positive on it.
They never have.
You could do that.
That's a good idea. And let them call the regulation. I think that's good. Huh? Or Department of Law. Or
whichever you prefer.
I don't care. It seems to me. Yeah. I don't know which you
prefer. I should point out that
Department of Law is drafting. They draft regulations anyway.
They review all regulations,
right,
too.
But they generally draft them, too. So you keep it all in one neat little place.
By doing what? Giving it to the Department of Law?
Giving it to the Department of Law. Since they review regulations anyway and actually do the drafting in most instances, they have the responsibility for formulating them, it would put it all in one place.
I'd rather think this one. You know, when people are confiscating your car, part of the law to it, and then the police can follow the regulations.
So, there's nothing wrong with it.
I think we should probably inquire of the Department of Law where they want the forfeiture power in terms of we should make the regulations. But are you in agreement though with the 2 and 3 provisions there? Because 2 was not too controversial, but 3 is.
Mrs. Wright?
Yeah.
Well, I think that
with the regulations set out, how you're going to determine whether the person was conducting, financing, managing, supervising, directing, or owning, and would the regulations set out
I think
how to make the determination as to whether that money that is found is part of the gambling pool?
Well, they could be that.
Would the regulations figure out whether the money that's found is part of the better state?
Well, they could create certain presumptions
it
on that.
It seems to me that it's sort of open now.
Yeah.
And
but I think it's, you know, someone's going to have to move a forfeiture.
Yeah.
And they're going to have to establish, if it's not done incident to the conviction.
Well, this is a murky area, but it seems to me possible that the property might be automatically forfeited unless the person owning it brought an action to enjoin the forfeiture. I mean, that's a possibility. I know under this law that says that officers shall destroy gambling implements, that was brought, I think, by the owner of the merchandise as an in-rem proceeding. Very complicated stuff, really.
If you're saying subject to forfeiture, then you're setting out a procedure and you're not saying that it's automatic. But if you just say shall be forfeited, then you're right. It should be forfeited unless somebody protesting was able to prove that it wasn't, it didn't fall under one of the three categories. That's why I asked about the language subject to forfeiture.
The language would bear your interpretation, but I'm not convinced that it would necessarily be interpreted that way.
Is the intent of the committee that this forfeiture provision only apply to people that have been convicted of one of those offenses? That we're making the criminal forfeiture, it's an incident to the conviction of an offense.
Well, it seems to me it's got to be. I mean, if it's used as a better state.
Well, see, forfeiture also entails civil forfeiture. It is forfeiture can work, and that's one of the problems about leaving it just like it is, that the state could move against the person civilly in rem against the item, and it's just establish it by, I think, basically by preponderance of the evidence that was used, even though the person may never have been convicted of unlawful gambling.
What's in rem?
In rem is an action where you're proceeding against the item, so it's state versus cocktail glass, or state versus slot machine. My own feeling on forfeiture is that it should only be after a conviction in terms of in the criminal code.
I've got problems with that. I don't think that I'm worth that. You know, you go into one of these big joints and they got slot machines and these factory made food tables and other poker tables and dice games and roulette wheels and these carpets that, you know, you have to buy that has all the whatever they play on. Dice tables and stuff. There's some real big special
gathering. What is special about the carpets?
The difference is, though, is that in the code we've got the offenses that cover that kind of conduct. In other words, you've got the offenses of promoting gambling, which is going to be a crime. I mean, you know, that kind of.
We're talking about forfeiture. We're not talking about what we can convict him of. We're talking about forfeiture.
Okay.
I'm saying.
Well, I think you're putting the issue.
I'm
very.
If you fail to get a conviction because the boss that was running the thing and all is down the street at that time and he wasn't there. When the guys go in and raid the place,
mm-hmm.
that he gets to keep all this stuff, I think the state should be able to, based on that type of equipment, go civilly against him and seize this, even though they may not convict him.
Now that's the issue.
Well, it's that they do that now.
Plus, occasionally you'll get a plea bargain where he's not going to be convicted of any of these gambling offenses. They may drop that particular charge and convict him of some other more serious charge or different charge. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
I don't agree with you, Ray. I'd like to see, let's not have the state's hands in there.
I think there's just a constitutional problem about it. In other words, having forfeiture, I think forfeiture is in fact a criminal penalty, and that the proof that your that would go under civil forfeiture is only clear and convincing or preponderance of the evidence. And I think that if we try to make it apply to civil, there's a fair chance that it would be held unconstitutional. A forfeiture is a penalty in some respects more severe than a fine. And I think that, I don't think that our court would really allow you to get around it by going civil.
If you heard that though somewhere, any device used for gamble in violation of this statute is will be forfeited. Or something like that, that are subject to regulation.
Well, we could do that and leave the question open for the court to determine whether you could go civilly.
It's a fascinating question because the way the law is now, all of this stuff is illegal. So, money, I agree there's a real question on money, but gambling devices are supposed to be destroyed under present law, but under this law, you can have gambling devices and use them in a social game.
And that's why we
decided you changed the question about the propriety of a civil forfeiture, and I really don't know the answer to the question.
I think we've got enough unanswered questions in the whole in advance of this.
Okay, we'll
take
care of the public.
Alexi.
You're going to walk down now?
Okay, that's it. Thank you. Thanks, Dean.
Sweet. Thanks.
Jim, stick around. I want to speak to Barbara. Just in terms of some of this.
I know if I got a copy of your final judgment.
Okay.